Small Town Podcast is made possible by generous support from the Georgia Municipal Association. GMA supports Georgia cities. Small Town Podcast is supported by Consolidated Pipe and Supply Company. Consolidated Pipe is a full-line supplier of products for the water, wastewater, and natural gas industries, and they serve utilities and public works departments in cities, large and small, every day. They're the exclusive distributor of Master Meter AMI-AMR technology. As a family-owned company with a legacy that began in 1960, let Consolidated Pipe show you that they are dedicated to service.
I hereby call this episode to order.
Hey, small towners, it's Mayor Matt Seal, and thanks for joining me for another episode of Small Town Podcast. On our previous episodes, we've checked in with small towns that we featured before on the podcast just to see how they were doing. For this episode, I decided to have a broader conversation about small towns and rural communities to discuss how they're currently doing and what the impacts of the global pandemic might mean for small towns moving forward. So today, we're going to go talk with Larry Hansen of the Georgia Municipal Association and Deb Brown from SaveYour.Town. Come go with me.
Growing up in coastal Georgia, I only thought I lived in a small town. Soon as I graduated high school, I moved to the big city of Atlanta for college and to start my life. But life is a journey, and I ended up in Ocilla, Georgia. Population 3,400. We've got two traffic lights here. We're not looking to get a third anytime soon. Some years later, the people of Ocilla made me their mayor. Man, I love living in a small town. Other folks do too. This is the Small Town Podcast, and I'm your host, Mayor Matt Seal of the great city of Ocilla, Georgia.
Small Town Podcast is sponsored by Public Software. While the name may sound new, Public Software has been helping small towns, cities, counties, and utility districts for over 50 years. They provide integrated software to help manage utility billing, accounting, and additional services. They help organizations accurately calculate, collect, and distribute money, print and mail statements, and effectively manage budgets. Some say they are a B2B company, but Public Software is focused on H2H, human-to-human connections. With decades of proven success and reliable service, let them make your software applications work seamlessly with the human interactions in your community. You can learn more about Public Software and what they can do for you and your organization by visiting www.publicsoftware.com. That's www.publicsoftware.com. Public Software. Strong relationships, stronger communities. First, I wanted to talk with someone who has been involved with small towns and cities on a bigger level to see how local governments are faring through our current crisis. I could think of no one better than Larry Hansen, the executive director of the Georgia Municipal Association. Larry has served in a local government for decades and now leads the organization that serves the 538 municipalities in the state of Georgia. I can speak from experience that Larry and the team at GMA have been an incredible resource for Georgia cities through this pandemic, providing daily information and updates and advocating at the state and federal level on behalf of all of us. This is especially valuable to small towns like Ocilla that don't have the resources to keep up with things on our own in this rapidly changing environment. I asked Larry for an overview of how local governments are doing and what we can expect moving forward.
All right, we're now on the line or in the Zoom room with the Executive Director of the Georgia Municipal Association, Mr. Larry Hansen. Larry, thanks for joining us again on Small Town Podcast.
Hey, Matt, it's great to be back with you and looking forward to spending some time today talking about Georgia cities and small towns in our state.
Well, the theme of our conversations today is kind of, I don't know, checking the pulse of towns. And I know you, of course, represent all 538 cities, regardless of their size and population in the state of Georgia. Of course, we're interested in small towns more specifically, but just kind of checking the pulse as things start to open back up and there's some uncertainty and some optimism. I guess I'll just ask the question that's generally, how are we doing as local governments in the state of Georgia? I know some are suffering more than others as a result of number of cases and things like that, but overall, what are you seeing across the state in our local governments?
Sure. Well, Matt, as you know, this is an unprecedented time in our nation's history and in our state's history. And so there's so much we've all had to learn collectively. Anytime you have something that is novel and new, no one really can predict what is going to happen. And that's what we've been all living through here in Georgia. I have been so impressed with the quality of the leadership of our city officials and how they've really stepped up. And I do applaud cities and city officials because I think they've shown tremendous leadership during this pandemic. And we have given consistent advice to the governor. Cities were often the ones leading and making some of the hard decisions at home to try and protect people. I admire how cities have responded to be able to continue to provide all the necessary services they have to keep our community safe and thriving, yet doing it in a way that helps also to protect their employees. So these are challenging times, and I've watched with great admiration how cities have stepped up to lead the way.
Now, you have played a key role in dealing, well, very directly with our governor's office and with the legislature. And obviously, there's questions coming all around about, you know, legislative action. And you're also dealing with, I know, our congressional delegation in the U.S. Congress level. Just speak to some of that. I know you can't go into some level of detail sometimes. So we want to respect confidentiality of some of those conversations. What kind of reliance should we have? How is this all supposed to work? And this is so unprecedented. So just right. Kind of speak to that in general.
You know, one of the things that's been a challenge about this is this virus has not affected our state uniformly, and it's not been consistent. There's been early on a city like Albany that has just really been horrible consequences. But now here we are months later, and other cities are facing similar situations as Albany. The city of Gainesville, Carrollton was a hot spot. The Dublin area was a hot spot. And yet many of our rural areas have not been hot spots in the same way. And so it lends itself to thinking that this disease certainly likes density. It likes environments where people are close together. Hence all the recommendations for social separation and maintaining distance and things of that nature. The state has not been uniformly negatively impacted, but all of the state has been impacted. And we're seeing a lot of our cities are negatively impacted on the revenue side, regardless of size, whether it's a loss of tourism, whether it's a loss of interstate travel, sales tax down, alcohol and restaurants fees down. So many ways that cities are being negatively impacted, but also on the cost side, overtime of police, safety equipment, anything healthcare related, firefighters, EMS. All those costs are up substantially. So part of what we've been trying to do is, of course, work with the federal government and the state government to help our cities secure funding. The CARES Act that was passed by Congress made available funding to all the states in the country and also only the largest 36 cities in America. So one city in Georgia qualified, the city of Atlanta. Four counties in Georgia qualified, but yet 537 cities were left out. So the state received $4 billion in funding from the federal government. And out of the state share, the share for those four counties in the city of Atlanta was removed. And so we together, GMA and ACCG, have made a request to the governor's office for him to share 45% of the state's remaining share with cities and counties. That amounts to about $1.2 billion. And I'm proud to say that we in GMA and ACCG are together, that we've agreed to share that equally. So if we're successful, that would be about $600 million to the cities of Georgia and $600 million for the counties of Georgia. And we've actually set up a program already. There would be three funding cycles. It is for reimbursable expenses because that's what the CARES Act legislation says. There has been some recent Treasury guidance that is loosening up the use of some, so we're encouraged by that. And I can tell you that Governor Kemp has made a commitment to share this funding. He formed a city and a county advisory committee. And on our city advisory committee, we have 22 city officials, most mayors. We meet every Wednesday morning. And about two Wednesdays ago, he personally was on the call for 10 minutes and he made a commitment to share. And then he followed up by having his director of OPB, Kelly Farr, on the call with us. He asked for some additional information. We provided that information. So we're encouraged, and we believe the state is going to share. Certainly, we're not sure if it'll be 45% or 25% or 22%, but we have every reason to believe. And at any of those levels, it would be a substantial benefit to the cities and the counties of Georgia. So we're actively working that, and we hope to have some guidance on that in the next couple of weeks. And in addition to the state side, there's expected stimulus four. Bills are being dropped, and there's a bill that would also provide direct funding to all cities in America and all counties in America that were not previously funded. We're monitoring that legislation. We are communicating daily with Georgia's congressional delegation and Georgia's senators to try and get the help and support we need for cities. The bills being introduced in Congress now would be a little more flexible. One of the restrictions of the CARES Act is it is for expense reimbursement, meaning it's for expenses only, and meaning it's reimbursement only, meaning you've got to spend it first to get it. And that's going to become an issue in the coming months with cities having cash flow issues. This legislation would allow revenue replacement, and it would be a block grant formula. So in other words, you would get a direct allocation to use as you need best for your city. And so we're pursuing that vigorously, working very closely, have a lot of support with our Georgia delegation. And so that's two of the big things we're working on right now at GMA, is sharing of the CARES Act funding with the state and working on a stimulus four bill with the federal government.
There's a lot going on. There's a lot of moving parts. I appreciate you taking care of that for us on behalf of all 538 of us. Yeah. So it's 537. Don't get automatic funding, like you said. Yeah. Tell me this. I'm going to leave this question kind of open-ended, because when I do this, you always give me good answers, because I enjoy your observations. You are in a lot of conversations with a lot of people all over the state and even in our nation's capital. What do you think this has taught us as city officials, as local government leaders? Either that we were doing really well already and this just confirmed that, or here's a lesson learned. Oh my goodness, we weren't prepared for this. And I'm sure most people, you know, we've made some quick pivots and done what we needed to do for sure. But it was kind of a caught us off guard, and this may change how we govern at some level in the future.
Well, Matt, I think there are several examples of that. One, I think our cities and local governments learned a lot through the 2008-9-10 recession, and many were still struggling to get back to where they were, but yet they learned some foundational principles from that. And I think I applaud our cities because most all are well-run, they're fiscally conservative, they're responsible in how they spend money, and I think that's been a great example. You know, it's interesting. As a city manager, I used to have citizens complain that they felt we had too much of a fund balance, that we should be using that money. But when you have these rainy days, and this is going to be a prolonged rainy days, it really proves how critical it is that a city have financial reserves. And we're finding that so many of our cities were in that boat to be able to have money set aside so that when you have a situation like this, you can survive. So I applaud them for that. And a lot of that was lessons learned from 08, 09, 010. But obviously, that's why we want to help supplant that funding in the coming months so that they can use that rainy day fund to survive for a period of time, but we can get the resources that they need. I also think that we're learning a lot of lessons about work from home. And I think that you're going to see leaders in cities and governments and associations really warm up to that idea and realize from this experience. For instance, we've been working remotely for about 2 months at GMA. We don't have a single person in our building, yet we've been able to continue to serve our cities, and most would not even be aware that we're not physically in our building. And I think likewise, I'm hearing that with a lot of cities. A lot of cities have transitioned to doing online permitting and, you know, online applications. Many already were. And even having to learn, even if it's just out of necessity, how to have online meetings. So I do think that we, in some ways, will work smarter and work more efficiently and learn that we can work remotely and perform jobs at the same level, and even in some cases, probably an advanced level, and not all have to physically be in a building. So I think that bodes well for the future to avoid cost of enlarging buildings or building new buildings if you realize that a much of your work can be performed successfully from home. So I think cities are setting good examples for others to follow of good financial stewardship, of finding ways to get the job done no matter what, and also doing everything possible to keep their employees safe. You know, when that 911 call comes in, someone expects the police to respond. And when there's a fire, someone expects the fire department to respond. And they often fail to think that they too, we have a duty and an obligation to protect them and make sure that we're keeping them safe and their families during this crisis. So I think cities have really just stepped up, as I said earlier, and shown tremendous leadership in how they've responded to this pandemic and this crisis.
All right, now I've got my small town specific question. You actually kind of you mentioned this in one of your previous answers about things. Obviously, everybody in the state's been affected by this, but not everybody evenly. Are you noticing, or maybe there's even some conversations? And I'll give an example: when you close all the schools and the students need to stay home, and we need to do assignments and schoolwork and instruction over the internet, but there's places in some of our rural counties, and I can attest to this. Ocilla is fine, but the outlying parts of Irwin County, there are places where there's not suitable high-speed internet for people. How is some of those realizations going to change things, or how does this kind of affect, I don't know in which direction, I guess the urban-rural divide that's been very prevalent in the last several years?
Those are great points and great questions. And here's my thoughts on that. I think you're already seeing the federal government directly through USDA, through the FCC, come out with innovative grant programs to really help accelerate broadband deployment all over America and a number of places in Georgia. And through the Georgia Department of Community Affairs, we're receiving funding. I serve on a DCA advisory committee. DCA was really a leader in getting this entire state mapped to know exactly where the deficiencies are, to be able to get some of this money and get it deployed. And now, of course, also the issue before has been the resources versus the demand. There was not as much demand in the rural areas. Now the demand is there, as you said. Children are being educated at home. Parents are working from home. And so there's a need and there's a demand. And now there's some funding resources. And so I think you're going to see private investment. So I'm optimistic about what I'm seeing now. All of a sudden, there's a sense of urgency to deploy broadband everywhere, and that's important. The rural-urban thing is interesting. I actually read a survey in recent days where people were asked about that, and even a number of even younger people, 30 to 40% of them said they're considering moving to a less populated area because of what they've lived through. I do think that it's a great economic development opportunity for small towns and small communities and rural areas and less densely populated areas to seize upon that, to talk about the quality of life you have and that you're not densely populated. And it's a great place to live and work and raise a family. And yet you can still be close to the interstate or close to the Atlanta airport or close to whatever it is that company may need to perform the job that they think. But I do think that this will be a potential game changer. And certainly it won't be overnight. And the nature of some businesses are they need to bear where they need to be to serve their customers. But I do think that you will see a trend emerge where you're going to see companies much more interested in looking beyond and looking to communities that perhaps they overlooked or were not on their radar list in the past. I think that's going to happen.
If you need to put a satellite office of GMA in Ocilla, we'll start looking for a site for you tomorrow. Well, Larry Hansen, thanks so much for giving us your time. I know it's very valuable with all these conversations and conferences. I'm sure I'm not your first Zoom conference call today.
Matt, I just want to tell you how much we at GMA appreciate what you do. Not only are you an incredible mayor, providing leadership, serving on our board and many other ways with GMA, but your small town podcast and the reach that it's had and the stories that it's told of small cities, I too think that's a great tool to educate people and open the minds of people about small town America and small town Georgia and how wonderful it is. And so I applaud you too for doing this show, and it's had a major impact, and we appreciate our relationship with you.
Well, I appreciate the support I get from GMA, especially that commercial that plays at the January conference every year. I always get a kick out of that. So Larry, thanks so much for joining us for your time.
Thank you, Matt.
All right, bye-bye.
Hey guys, it's Matt Seal. And since you're listening to Small Town Podcast, you're probably a fan of small towns and want to see them thrive, just like I do. For small towns to thrive, small town businesses need the tools to succeed in the digital economy of today's fast-paced world. Irwinomics is the producer of Small Town Podcast. We also do digital media production and marketing for small businesses in our community and have recently started expanding our business to meet new demands. We love small towns. and we want to see them not only survive, but thrive. We believe they can. We believe that small businesses are the key to that growth. It's the traditional mom-and-pop retail, manufacturing, agriculture, and service businesses that are embedded in your community that make it what it is, that brings that unique character to your small town. They are your friends and neighbors, and they help make up the fabric of your community. In order for those businesses to continue and grow in this fast-changing and increasingly digital world, Irwinomics is here. We know that now more than ever before, small businesses need someone that they can trust to help with the very necessary aspect of digital marketing and advertising. Your digital presence is just as important as your physical presence, if not more so. Irwinomics helps clients with all aspects of your digital communications, from website creation and maintenance, social media, email lists and newsletters, and making sure that all of those things are working together to build your business beyond the city limits and county lines so that you can focus on keeping your community strong and vibrant. Make sure that you're getting noticed and staying relevant. For more information and to see how Caitlin, Bailey, and I can guide you into growing your business, go to Irwinomics.com or contact us through Small Town Podcast. That's IRWINOMICS.com. Irwinomics, helping small towns survive and thrive. Small Town Podcast is supported by the Southern Mercantile. Visit southernmercantile.com for a blog about small town living and an online store with a selection of carefully curated goods. The Southern Mercantile. Simple living, Southern charm. After looking at things from a local government angle, I wanted to turn and look at things from the economic perspective. While local government leaders have to do things with the local economy in mind, there are certainly different conversations that occur when you focus very specifically on the business community. My next guest sees trends that were in play before the current crisis began that may be accelerated by what is going on now. Over the long term, these trends could potentially change things, maybe in a good way, for small towns in rural areas of the country. All right, now I'm joined, not live, but via Zoom, and not in person, it's via Zoom, but I'm virtually in Webster City, Iowa, with Deb Brown of SaveYour.Town. So Deb, thanks for joining me for the podcast and talking with us today.
Well, I'm really excited because, as you know, I love small towns, and here you are in Osceola.
That's right.
Small town, and you're the mayor, and I'm interested as well to talk to you about your viewpoint, the city viewpoint on things, the governmental viewpoint, because I come from a little bit different angle. So I think we'll have a good conversation.
Let's talk about that, because like I told you, this is a little bit of a departure for me from my normal small town podcast episode. Usually I sit down with a local elected official. Usually I'm in their town, not talking via Zoom over, although the last couple episodes I've been checking in with folks through this same medium. We're talking about a little more of the economic impacts of COVID-19 specific to small towns. And because you have such a network of people you talk to regularly, I know you're not doing a lot of speaking at conferences right now, but you have over the years. And so that was why I'm very, very interested in your perspective. But before I do that, as I always do, I like to get to know my guests a little bit. So give us a little bit of background about, you know, where you grew up and how you kind of got into this crusade, which is kind of similar to mine, about trying to help small towns revitalize through various ways. So I'll ask my first question, like I always do. Were you born in Webster City, Iowa?
No, I was not.
Tell
us
where you
started out. I was actually come from a small town of 141 people.
That's pretty
called
small.
Geneva, Iowa, and I actually didn't live there. I lived on a farm outside of town. So yeah, with my mom and at that time just me, and I have two younger brothers. So grew up there, went to school in that area. I loved school. It was so much fun. I loved to read and participate and be in drama club and all those fun things. I think that's a good indicator of somebody that wants to work in a community. Look what they did in school. You know, were they active? Were they involved? And then I went away to college because most people in Iowa go away to college. Our numbers are pretty good. And ended up in a roundabout way, I have a long history, in Chicago, where I lived for about 25 years. Met a man, married, he had a couple of kids, which meant I did, and worked in underwriting, foreign insurance, casualty insurance. Did a lot of retail management because I realized I wasn't the person to sit in a cubicle, that didn't work very well for me. So I went into retail and did retail management. Managed an internet cafe where I really met I had some staff. They were all younger. At that point, I was in my 40s. And these kids taught, and I mean kids, still in school, taught me so much about the internet and about all the different apps and to not be afraid of it. And that really kind of sent me just a little bit different direction eventually. We got tired of winter. I don't know if you've ever been in Chicago in the wintertime, but it's not fun weather-wise. Ended up in North Carolina, where a friend and I, long story how we met, but anyway, we started our own bingo parlor. I know, right? Isn't that great to have on your
resume?
That's
the first time I've ever met someone that started their own bingo parlor, so this is unique.
Bingo's pretty big in North Carolina, and my friend was an expert at it, so why not? That was my one of my first getting my hands dirty with my own business, and we lasted a couple of years and said, that's enough of that. And then ended, my dad had a heart attack, and we ended back up in Iowa, back in the Geneva area. And I had my own consulting business where I was doing social media kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the Chamber of Commerce, I volunteered there because I wanted to get to meet all the other businesses. And they hired me to do their marketing and communications. And when the Chamber job, executive director job came up in Webster City, I applied for it and got it. It was pretty cool. And about 5 years ago, Becky and I started working together and created SaveYour.Town. And we work with small towns. We don't tell them what to do because that would be rude. I wouldn't want somebody to come to my town and tell me what to do.
Well, they probably wouldn't take it very kindly either.
No, not at all. No. And we wouldn't either. So yeah, we're both small town people. But we help them see the things that they're not seeing with their own eyes. Just being a new set of eyes in a community can be helpful and help them realize that they have permission to do whatever they want to do. They really, for 99% of the things that need to be done, they don't need permission from anybody else. And then we work through the idea-friendly method so that they can get things done and show them how to do it based on what they want, not on what I want.
That was quite an interesting journey, all the different things you've done over the years and all the small town experiences that ended up kind of coalescing into what you do now. You actually found me because of the podcast, and I'm now a subscriber on your newsletter. And so I get the different things you and Becky put out, and it's very interesting perspectives, like what you just said about not needing permission. And a lot of people think, well, I'm supposed to get permission. We're supposed to get help from either the state or the federal level. And there are so many things that we can just do on our own. And with a smaller population, you just have to convince less people to go along with you in order to get things done sometimes. So talk about that. I almost want to call it a crusade because that's what it comes across as with you guys in the newsletters and the videos and things. What is it you do with SaveYour.Town? What would people expect? Give them a little plug on the newsletter.
Sure, absolutely.
But yeah, because now you speak a good bit, and like I mentioned recently, obviously conferences are not as popular.
They're coming though. Pandemic. They're coming back.
Yes,
it's okay.
Yes. So I'm sure.
And we're
doing
some virtual ones as well.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, you've done. I've seen the webinars you've done and things like that. So you're still putting your message out there. But talk about what you and Becky are doing and how people might be able to get involved with that.
Absolutely. So the best way to begin is the free way, as in it's free, not the highway, to sign up for the newsletter. And just go to SaveYour.Town and you'll see where you can sign up. We send out an e-newsletter every week addressing whatever challenges rural towns are facing. And the reason we know the challenges, other than we're in the communities working, but also because we do a survey every other year and ask people, what are your challenges? What's not working for you? How can we help? And the surveys are pretty extensive, but they're wonderful to show us how we can be most effective. And many organizations, including the Fed, use those surveys for their rural reports that they do. And if you want to find those just to see them, they're at smallbizsurvival.com. In the upper left-hand corner, you can see the surveys. That's Becky's website that she's had since the mid-2000s.
If you don't mind, that's kind of the amount of information and experiences that you guys have kind of been able to gather through the surveys, through the visits, through the things that you've done. We're definitely going to talk about how small towns are being affected by COVID-19. But yeah. You and I had an interesting conversation as we were setting up for this about trends that were happening even before a global pandemic. So speak to that. Kind of, it seems like things were kind of shifting in some ways from metropolitan or urban areas to rural areas. So talk about the trend you saw even before we get to what's going on right now.
So what we've been noticing, and it's growing, and I anticipate it's going to grow even more with what's going on in COVID. Here's a few benefits of living in a small town. It's a lower cost of living, almost always. Safer streets. Kids can actually play on the sidewalk. Normally better schools, normally. You can work remotely there. Did you know about 33% of people employed in Washington, D.C. work remotely throughout the United States? That's a third of them. And that's going to drop as well. I mean, that's going to raise it.
Right. The number of people that want to go into the office is going to drop.
yep. And right now, there's many jobs available. And not just taking care of hogs and cattle, which are some of the jobs available, but working in industry and engineers and safety people and all kinds of corporate level jobs are available too. And people think if you go work for a chemical factory that you're going to be on the line and packing chemicals. Now, that's an option. However, there's a lot more options, and we forget to say that about our small towns. That's important. It's an opportunity if you've recently married and have kids to come home with your kids because you want them to grow up like you did. Almost everybody tells us that. It's easier to start a business in a small town. An example would be small-scale manufacturing. So say you have this brilliant idea, you want to make widgets. So you could be in a building where it's retail in the front and you could be the widget making in the back of it. And I'll talk about some of those opportunities, how to make that happen in a little bit here. And frankly, you're a bigger fish in the smaller pond, which means you can be as active as you want to be in your community and be really involved. I mean, you can do political things, you can do volunteer, nonprofit. There's plenty of places for everybody to be involved in a community and make a true difference.
I will say this, I've got, you know, several friends now that are in local government, elected officials throughout the state and now different states. And it's much more fun to be a small town mayor than a big city mayor.
Yes, sirree, Babaloo. Yeah, right.
Well, those were what you just talked about were trends and opportunities and advantages that existed pre-COVID-19, pre-global pandemic.
Yeah.
But I'm very interested to hear your stories of how small towns are doing because of COVID-19. Obviously, the same restrictions, the same economic impact to some degree is just existing everywhere, regardless of whether it's metropolitan or very sparsely populated rural areas. What might be happening different and how might rural areas maybe come out of this differently, if that's the right way to ask it? What's your sense of that?
Well, what I see in small towns that I don't see in cities as much is we are helping each other. Our restaurants had to close. They couldn't serve inside food, but they figured out how to do delivery, how to do curbside service, how to create a food truck. And by simply putting on Facebook, anybody got an old food truck I can buy or an old truck I can convert? And people come out of the woodwork and say, yes, I do. You can have it. Let me help you with it. And those are the kind of things that happen in small towns if you're not afraid to ask for help. Often we stop ourselves from asking, and there's no crime in asking for help because you get the opportunity for somebody on the other end to provide some help, and we all want to be helpful. So just the conversations, the way people get along. I had heard about a grant, and I sent it to 6 business owners I knew. You don't see that happening in a city. Our community, our town, had $250,000, some leftover money from an old USDA grant from 30, 40 years ago, and they were able to convert it into grants for small businesses to either $2,500 or $5,000 grants to just get them through these couple of months. So again, you don't see those kind of things. You get in a big city, now you're at federal level and it's harder than heck and the PPP got all screwed up. And, you know, I could talk about funding in a big city with a big name bank, but I can call, which I did, I called my local bank and said, hey, what do you know? How's this working out? Can you help me with anything? And they were extremely helpful and walked people through their processes, that PPP. You had a bit, second time around, you had a better chance of getting that grant if you worked with a small local bank.
Yeah.
These are the things that matter.
I got text messages on Saturdays and Sundays from the banker that helped us with some of those things. And I was I told him, I said, I feel like this is different than I would have gotten in a big city. So thanks for the extra,
definitely.
Extra effort and the personal touch. So certainly that's been true here in this village too.
It's also important to, as we live in these small towns, think about, and Ben Winchester said it, he's a sociologist at the University of Minnesota, where we live is really the center of everything. It's not the center of nowhere. It's the center of everything.
Middle of everywhere. Yeah.
Yes, the middle of everywhere. Because in rural, your circumference around you that you do things in is about 45 miles. Where you shop, where you work, where you live. You can think of 45 miles where you're doing stuff. Now, who lives in that area? That's a region. So as small towns, we can, and counties, we can start thinking about and start acting upon, how can we work better together regionally? Who do I know that might need some help over in Williams, which is 10 miles away? And I can pick up the phone and say, hey, what are you doing? You need me to volunteer? So the regional is another great reason to move here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll tell you that I live about 50 minutes from Des Moines, which is our state capital. Mm-hmm. And when people say, there's no culture there, I'm like, well, you haven't been to my town, first of all. We have awesome community theater and amazing Pulitzer Prize winners, two of them that came from here. And I can be to Des Moines and see world-class civic engagement things. Yeah. So don't tell me that. Just think about what you actually have around you. And that's how you promote your community, actually. All of those things.
Well, as we are starting to, and I know it is even some controversy about the speed at which we should reopen things in the economy, I'd want to ask you kind of two things. Well, it might be three things. How have small towns in general, and everyone's going to be different based on the level of impact from number of cases and all kinds of different variables, how have small towns, rural communities fared compared to what we're seeing on the news? Because the news I watch, make sure to tell me about New York City first, and then talk about other major cities, but not a whole lot of reporting on the small town. So how is that going comparatively? How do you see small towns coming out of it? And I guess just speak to what kind of effects, kind of going back to our question before about how does this change things with regard to that trend about how people were already kind of maybe looking at rural a little more for business and raising a family. So I know I just asked you a bunch of things, but I'm just kind of interested in of them, and I don't know which way to go first.
Totally get where you're going with this. So if you think about your town, I bet you can think of two or three businesses that were probably just hanging on by a thread and were just didn't know how they were going to go forward, or they were barely making payroll. I mean, every community has that. Those businesses probably won't make it through COVID. I just don't see that happening. I see if we are smart, particularly you nice city folks, city officials, let me get that straight, would help them with some succession planning or help them close up and do it in a nice, kind, friendly way. So why would you have them invest another $2,000 when in a month or two, they're going to have to pay it back anyway? They're going to have to take that loan and pay it back. So how can we kindly help those that aren't going to make it? And there will be some that aren't going to make it for one reason or another. One might be that they haven't stepped into this age of technology. Another might be their product doesn't work anymore. I mean, there's 1,000 different reasons that people still try to hang on and do things the old way. And we're in a new kind of way now. We're not in the old way anymore. We have to start thinking differently. So if you want to be kind, you would help those people through that process. And maybe there could be some restructuring, or there might be some, if they have equipment, maybe you can help them find another user for that equipment so at least they can come out with a little money in their pocket. If you want to do real succession planning, go to your local bankers. They know people at the state level that can come in and talk about succession planning. Now, I think when you start a business and you're in your 30s and 40s, you should already have your succession plan in place. Sounds crazy, right? But this is how you expand over the next 20 years, by bringing in someone that may want to be an employee and work with you and eventually buy you out. You guarantee that your business continues long after you've retired or long after you're gone, so that the next generation doesn't have to go through, Matt, what we're going through now in so many businesses closing. So that's the bad news, if there is any bad news about that. And the good news is there are so many different ways to start businesses, just so many different ways that people kind of haven't thought about. And besides remote working, that's nice, but you're working for somebody else. I'm going to share a couple of things that I know actually work. Shared spaces is one. So say you have an empty building, and I know every small town has one, and the owner lives in town. We'll have that owner live in town, and they sure would like to rent that building. Having that conversation and say, hey, we have this idea. Why don't we do something like they did in Grand Rapids? It's called the Modiv Shops in Grand Rapids, and they have little sections of the building are separate different businesses. This business rings up all through one register and it allocates, you know, Square will do that, allocates to the correct business. There's a woman that, Rose Ellis is her name, and she's an artist, and she wanted to be, they had a huge front window on one side, and she wanted to be on that side because she paints large paintings. So she actually does her work in her shop in the window that faces out. And Rose has said, this was, you couldn't get me out of here with a crowbar. It is the best business plan I never thought of. And it's turned her life around. Huge wow. difference just by being in that public kind of place. In Grand Rapids, that just started out as an experiment to fill vacant retail space. Yeah. That they were having their own downturn at that time. And it was really has become a successful place for launching startups. Because it gives that startup an opportunity not to rent the whole building or buy the whole building, having never tested their product out to see if it would even sell. You don't, you know, as a new startup, you don't want to do those things. You want to try it out. You want to do small tests. You want to adjust. You want to make sure that it works. Another idea, we did this in our community. It's called the Incubator Project. I live in Webster City, and we had a major manufacturer that left. Lock, Stock, and Barrel went to Mexico. And we were a factory town at that point. Over 2,000 jobs were gone, just gone. And the city and the community, Webster City, had a really hard time with it because they had to go from being, their identity was stolen, basically. We're no longer, this is not who we are anymore. Yeah. When I came for my job, that was in 2011. When I came in 2013, I was driving through downtown. I counted 14 empty buildings in a 4-block area. That's a lot of empty buildings. Yeah, it is. And I knew it was going to be my job to fill them. So I just had this idea. Let's do a tour of empty buildings. Okay. Why not? Right? Sure. Why not? Let's show them off. So a month later, I had no concept of time, mind you. Take 2 months to put that together. But we invited everybody at every economic development level all throughout the state. We were all over social media. We had the building owners or the realtors there, sometimes both. We had what we call our chamber champions. So these are retired people that knew the history of that area, of that building. So they were there to talk about what had been there before and what maybe could be there coming up. So we did this tour. We had 44 people show up. We were happy with that result because these people were looking for a building to do some business in. And that 44, because we just kept talking about it. Have you seen this? Every time something happened, we blow it up. We got national attention for it, which was awesome. We were receiving calls from all over. Can we copy your idea? Yeah, go for it. Sure. Here's our plan, right? And just gave it to them. Within a year's time, 10 of the 12 buildings on that tour, within 18 months, excuse me, 10 of the 12 buildings on that tour were filled.
Wow.
Because we showed it off. We just talked about it. And we were so excited and so proud about it. And everybody got on board. They needed something to rally around. And that was it.
Wow.
Now it gets better. The incubator project came out of that. So one of the building owners had two buildings and we were visiting with her and sat down and she's like, I need to rent these buildings and I don't know what to do. And, you know, I'm a farm girl, grew up on a farm and had this idea. Well, let's do an incubator project. So you think of the old incubators, which the baby chicks stayed under right. for a few months until they got big enough, right? Same kind of idea. Free rent, first 3 months. Reduce rent for the rest of the year. The tenant pays the utilities and they get to try out their business idea. The chamber helped with providing marketing and teaching them marketing skills. And the Small Business Development Center helped with creating a business plan. Now, at the end of 3 months, if they didn't have a good start on a business plan, then we knew they weren't interested. Well, that project worked, actually. So that project worked really well, except the first one that came in was a used clothing and goods store. In 3 months, they left town and took all the money that they'd gotten from people.
Oh, no.
So we were a little nervous. I'm like, hold on. This is why we got the insurance. This is why we did all this stuff. It's okay. And then the next one was a restaurant, a woman that wanted to have an Italian restaurant. Oh my God, it was amazing. It's just some of the best food you can even imagine. And a year later, they had to leave. Her husband got a job offer in another state that was 3 times his salary. They couldn't turn it down.
Yeah.
And we are always family first. So we had no problem with them going. But what happened, the Mexican grocery store across the street was working on opening their restaurant in the back, but they weren't ready yet. That hood that cost, I don't know, crazy amounts of money, $80,000, they needed to raise that fund. So they went over and they opened up a Mexican restaurant, just like they're going to open up. And so that they could have people taste their food, they could get recommendations and comments and make some money so they could open their own restaurant. So the incubator project, right now both buildings are empty, but that won't be long because they keep it in the incubator project. And it's kind of a starting ground for people to try ideas and to try things without buying the whole building. So that's one idea, the incubator project.
I'm almost nervous to ask this because I'm going to ask you to speak to me. So one thing, because I'm on a lot of conference calls, of course, we're supported by the Georgia Municipal Association. We've been sponsored by the Louisiana Municipal Association. So a lot of people that listen to the podcast are either elected officials, appointed officials, or at least very engaged in their local small town government. So we've talked a lot about business, and I've got some business experience, but could always use some more advice. But with your experience, with all the things that you've seen, with some of your examples even, what advice would you give to the folks like me that are responsible for making what are about to be some pretty big decisions about opening up, about trying new things, about, you know, kind of having to do some of these supportive projects like the ones you just illustrated? What would you say to local elected officials, appointed officials, whoever in small towns about what we need to do or how we need to go about things in the coming days?
Loosen up some of your restrictions. Go back and look at some of those city codes that are stopping you from doing something and the code that was written in 1940 that no longer makes any sense. Don't let that code stop you from helping somebody out try an idea. You'd be amazed at the number of times we hear that. Another thing that you could do is you could become, and I'm particularly thinking of mayor and city council, the venture capitalist of ideas. Now, I know people come in and ask for money. We want to start this business and sure, we need $2,000. And you don't know anything about the business or them or how they conduct it, right? So you could listen, have them share their idea of what they want to do. Just listen. And then you could have that conversation. Well, be sure you've got to call the state and get your business license. Here's where you get that. You're going to have to do this. You're going to have to do that. Share your contacts and the people that you know that will make that process easier for them. And then see which ones work. And if they start working, if you've got one or two that really start working, now you can think about investing some money in it. But give everybody a chance to try their ideas out. Listen to what they have to say. And maybe you do that once a month or once a quarter and sit and figure out what kind of connections are they going to need. What kind of help are they going to need that are not financial or that might lead to financial from somewhere else? Just be really open and receptive to everybody. Not all the ideas will work, but be willing to try all the ideas. The good ones will rise to the top.
So be open to new ideas and freshen up the code book and the ordinances.
Yep. Iowa State University did a study of 99 towns over a 20-year time span. Mm-hmm. And what they found out, the towns that would survive and thrive were those that were open to new ideas, willing to try things.
That's for towns of every size, probably.
Yeah. Stop being so official and start listening to your kids. You know, what do your 20-year-olds want to do? How can you help them? How can you help the returning people? You need a daycare? Figure out how to get a city-run daycare in your community. Well, there we figure go. It out.
I got you some stuff to work on now.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Deb Brown, the website is saveyour.town. You can subscribe to the free newsletter there. Deb, any other place you want to send people to connect with you or with Becky or any of the things you're doing?
You know, if you go to saveyour.town, you're going to find everything you need to know about the things we do besides the newsletter. We do videos every month. We do travel. We do webinars. We do Zooms. Just about everything you can think of to be engaged with small towns and help them find their practical steps to a brighter future.
Well, Deb, I can tell it's a very genuine passion of yours, but I want to thank you for what you do for small towns and rural communities everywhere. And maybe I can make a road trip out to Iowa sometime. And
love to see you. Let me know when you're coming, for sure. Right.
Sounds good. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, small towners, that'll do it for this episode of Small Town Podcast. I want to thank Larry Hansen and Deb Brown for talking with me today. I hope everyone will continue to stay safe and healthy, even as we continue to open our businesses and our communities that need our support right now. As always, I want to thank our season sponsors, the Georgia Municipal Association, Consolidated Pipe, the Southern Mercantile, and Public Software, for supporting us as we explore and share great small towns. I'll talk to you soon, and y'all are always welcome to come to Osceola, but I hope you'll continue to stay safe and support a small town right where you are.
Small Town Podcast is an Irwinomics production. We release new episodes every other week featuring small towns through stories of the people who live and lead there. Our podcast episodes are made possible with editing assistance from Resonate Recordings, who also mixes and masters all of our episodes. You can subscribe to Small Town Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and the next episode will download while you sleep. You can also leave us a rating and review, which would help us reach new listeners. We would really appreciate it. Beyond our episodes, you can engage with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also learn more about us and the small towns we visit by visiting our website, www.smalltownpodcast.com. We'd love to show all you small towners out there some great images from the small towns we visit and let you know about the festivals and events you can participate in. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to see you real soon, because there's no place like Osceola, Georgia.
We stand adjourned.